Survival podcast is always one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, August the 13th, 2026, and this is episode 3882. Expert Council Q&A show, of course, for the week on Thursdays. I'm going to lead off with a few announcements. And then here's what else we're going to be talking about. Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini will do a segment that's basically socialist to the left of us, socialist to the right. And I completely agree with the sentiment. I do not agree with the criticism of the orange man in this particular case, though, when the orange man says we have a communist problem in the United States, as in an overt, open communist problem. Broken clocks are right twice a day, and Trump is right here. It doesn't mean that what he's pushing and the entire right is pushing and has been pushing for years isn't some flavor of socialism. Almost everything in our government is a flavor of socialism, more like a dimmer switch level of socialism. So we'll talk about that. Then Chef Ken will give us part two on his mushroom cooking series, specifically zoning in on oyster mushrooms and lion's mane. Doc Bones will talk about dealing with smoke inhalation injuries. Ryan Steve is going to give us kind of a grab bag of tech for your homestead. This is a really great segment. Probably need to talk more about stuff like this, honestly, in the future. We are also going to have then Annie McCann talk about how to get your spouse to work out. Way, way back in the day, and I guarantee you there was no planning and whatsoever that the number that this show ended up being, but it was episode 69. And so that takes us back to 2008. I did a show called Getting Your Spouse on Board with Prepping. Andy has a very similar question today. How do I get my spouse on board with working out? I really love his answer, and I'll just add a little bit to it. And then I'm going to talk to you about the new federal ruling and fallout about suppressors and SBRs out of a federal court in Texas. I think this is good news overall for most of the country. It actually presents a real problem for a lot of the country as well, though. And it's going to be an interesting series of fights that comes out of this. And there's some places where, like, basically, you might want to wait over the weekend for some clarity, but it looks like the whole world has just opened up and changed into common sense. Some states are going to be a gray area. Some states are going to be worse than they were before this. And so I do think there'll be a series of fights. I think this will go back to federal court. I think it's going to be very interesting. But one thing I can tell you is that this is not a situation where somebody's going to be able to sue from an outside entity. The DOJ decided not to appeal this federal court ruling. So it is law by proxy for now, but it doesn't mean the government can't change the rules in the future or change the definition of what things mean. It's kind of actually a really beautiful mess or a really ugly mess depending on where you live. And there's some things you're going to have to really take into consideration going forward. And I'm not advising that anybody without a full understanding of what's going on run out today and buy a suppressor just because your local shop will sell you one with nothing but a standard 4140 background checker. In some places, I think there's been some high-profile purchases where they're not even doing that. So we'll talk about what this means and what it could mean for our future in just a minute. Before I bring Dr. Paul and Chris on, though, to talk about socialists to the left, socialists to right, and we're stuck in the middle, a couple quick announcements. Number one, remember, on August 29th, I'm giving the keynote address at the West Virginia Home Educators Convention in Charleston, West Virginia. This is going to be a fantastic all-day event. I don't know exactly when my speaking spot is. It opens at 9. I'm guessing probably 10 for a keynote or 9:30 for a keynote. Give people time to get there, get through entry and stuff like that. But I'll also be sitting on a discussion panel, and it's going to be a great event. Even if you're not a homeschooler, I think you can support this because homeschooling is important for liberty for sure. But I also think you can come there and learn a lot too, especially if you hear my talk about using AI for home education, because everything I'm going to say that you can use AI for to help educate your children, You can use it to help educate yourself. In fact, one of my premises in this presentation is going to be that we should be educating children the same way we educate adults, because we should be raising adults. We parent children, but we raise adults, or we end up with 18-year-old adolescents, right? So you should be raising your children into young men and women. And so that can start with, we start to actually teach them in a way that shows that we respect their innate intelligence, and we understand that we need their buy-in to truly educate them. So I think you would really enjoy that. And even if you can't come to the event, we do have a meetup for TSP folks at 6:30 at Marriott Hotel. I'll put a link in the show notes today where you can find out more about it. I think it's like the Marriott Town Center. I think it's whatever hotel I'm staying at. They have a really great bar and restaurant called the Brick and Salt Grill at that location. Looks fantastic. So from 6:30 to 9:30, I will be making myself available. And one more time, because even with saying this, I've gotten some invitations. I am not coming to your house. You're not taking me out to dinner. I'm not going to come look at your thing or whatever it is. I appreciate the invites. I am in and out on this. I am flying in Thursday evening. I'm going to the hotel. I'm doing a run through on my presentation. I'm having dinner and I'm going to bed because I have to do a good job for these people. And then the next day I'm doing the event all day long. I'm going back to my hotel to chill for about an hour and a half and take a shower after being at an event all day. I'm doing a meetup with you guys. I'm getting up early in the morning, going to the airport, and coming home. So that is all the time that I have. Also a reminder, the AI course goes on sale that same week. We're actually dropping on Tuesday is when you can sign up for it. And to be specific, that is Tuesday the 25th of August. But you don't need to remember the date. What you need to do is go to jackslaws.com right now. Click on the coursework information where the different courses are you can take and pre-register for the AI Solopreneur course. And you need to do that so that you can get into the course when it launches that week. And then you'll have like a week to get everything together. Like once you sign up and you're an official student, you'll get some emails you get an email every day leading up to the course. And that'll get you ready, like installing the Telegram app and all the things you need to have ready to go when we start. Some things you'll need to be prepared with. And then that following Monday, which is going to be what, August 31. August 31 is the day that the course will officially actually begin. So you have about a week between sign up and start. We did that by design. This course is sold out now. Every round we've done is our fifth round. Four previous rounds sold out. I don't see why this one won't as well. So if you want to take part in it, go get signed up for it now. There's about 700 people pre-registered for it. 737 yesterday when I checked. 737 people pre-registered for 100 spots. So it's about a 1 in 7 chance if everybody tries to sign up. Not everybody's going to, but you're looking at 1 in 3. So great odds if you're on the list. Zero odds if you're not. Last, Monday. What is Monday going to be? Well, I recently went to a 3-show a week schedule. Last year I cut back to 4. That worked for me. I am not really feeling it doing 3 shows a week. I feel like I am pulled back too much. It's not like a direct effect on revenue or anything. We haven't been doing it long enough for that effect to be there. It just, the rhythm's wrong, and I feel like I'm leaving things not done and not said. And so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to have a halfway measure, at least initially, to see how this works out. I'm going to start doing a show on Mondays that's going to be a much more off-the-cuff show. Whatever the hell's on my mind, I'll make notes throughout the week. It'll be a lot like 2008, 2009, and the 2006.5 Jetta Diesel TDI, where it was off-the-cuff riffing. There'll be a blog post. It'll go out on the podcast thing. It'll be a live stream. You're probably looking at shows that are more in the neighborhood of 35 to 45 minutes, less elaborate show note putting together and things like that. Thankfully, with AI, I can speed that process up anyway. Maybe another way to look at it, if you remember what I did for a few years, I did about a year, I did Miyagi Mornings in addition to the podcast. So more like those, but they'll be in the podcast, right? So I think that might actually fill a niche that some people feel is missing with the show now. It's become too structured in some ways, and I think that can be true. I think as you mature a business, you mature something like programming, you can mature it too far, and maybe that's good for some things but not others. So I want to bring back some of the early day spirit from, you know, 15 to 18 years ago on our Mondays. And I don't know what we're going to call them yet, but if anybody has any good ideas, start with an M. You know, Melancholy Monday, that doesn't sound good, but Motivation Monday, I don't know. But a little bit of Jack ass kicking on Monday mornings for you to lead off your week. Quicker, faster paced, not fully structured. Probably, like, I usually go through, like, the agenda at the beginning. I'll just cut that off. We won't tell you what we're talking about. Some days I might not know. So I think that's probably a good play going forward. So I'm bringing back Monday shows, but a little bit of a different flavor of them. With all of that said, it is time to get into our expert panel Q&A show, because we've gone longer with an intro than I like to do, but I had a lot to cover there. But here's Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul, socialist to the middle, socialist to the left of us, socialist to the right of us. I'm stuck in the middle with you. Yeah, and clowns to the left of us, clowns to the right of us, that seems to be a thing too right now.
Our president has created a disaster in Iran. We talk about it virtually every day because it's the biggest news. And he suffered in the polls, terrible. Republicans, terrible. Democrats are expected to win in the midterm. So President Trump has latched onto, and his administration, that there's commies everywhere, you know, and you better put us back in. As bad as this is, you know, the commies are coming in. So I think Gavin Newsom is just, you know, he's giving it right back. He said Donald Trump is the leading socialist of our time. And he went on and on. It's ridiculous. And he ended with all hail Comrade Trump. And, you know, you can't really argue that much with him. You know, it's not like what Dr. Paul says, we have a total communist system, no. But there are very heavy socialistic tendencies on both sides.
One thought that crossed my mind, which I think is a little silly, but I thought it was a little bit entertaining, when I heard about this squabble between Newsom and Trump calling each other's name. And I got to thinking, well, if maybe this is an example of the pot calling the kettle black. You know, here you have probably one of the strongest dedicated believer in socialism, Newsom, lecturing and saying how bad Trump is. Well, we're trying to defend it in a way, but for a different reason, that it's not so much he can't be accused of being the typical socialist, but if you put socialism and broaden the term of authoritarianism, this is true, because the results end up the same.
Yeah, obviously we are opposed to socialism, all of its different forms, but in this life, you don't always get what you desire. We desire free markets, voluntary interaction, sound money, rule of law. But, you know, you don't always get what you want in this life. So let's say we had to really live under a communistic, socialistic government. Well, I would say the President Trump is the worst version of it, because he doesn't even use our government for us, but for a foreign nation, specifically Israel. You know, and all the people in government tell us this. They're on TV. So, you know, at least when you have socialism in South America, it may not work down there, but at least their intention is to try to help their own people. You know, we don't have that here. Now, the socialism won't succeed there, here, or anywhere else, but at least do it for your own people. Look at China. They're communist capital. They're some of the best capitalists in the world, but they're communists too. You know, putting all these names aside, one thing you can say about China is they are laser focused on China and taking care of the Chinese people and China itself. They're not fighting any wars. They're not doing any of this stuff that we do, you know. So they're focused on themselves. Our president and our government is focused on Israel. So we have the worst form of socialistic tendencies that you can imagine. You know, at least take care of us.
Well, I really agree with Chris's close there. For all of the negative I can say about China, And I can say this about many countries that do a better job of it than we do, that I don't particularly care for and not necessarily would want to live in. One that I would much rather live in than China, but still don't want to go there, would be Russia. A lot of these countries that are very authoritarian and have restrictions on liberty that we are drastically opposed to still do a better job of taking care of their own country than we do. I completely agree with that sentiment. What I don't agree with is that you can write off Trump's comments about communists just because Trump is a right-wing socialist, which every right-wing mainstream politician is as well. Period. The end of story. Like, there's no way. Rand Paul is a freaking socialist on some level. Like, I would say the dimmer switch has turned way to the left with Rand. No disrespect to Dr. Paul, his father, but Rand Paul has some policy positions that I would say are very socialist. I would say that the only person that served at the congressional level, either House or Senate, in my life, that 100% was divorced from the ideals of socialism and everything that he said and did, except final capitulation on, well, I guess this is the bill we have, and I got what I could for my district out of it to get it back for them, is Dr. Ron Paul himself. Not even Thomas Massey would meet that standard for me, and I love Tom, and I love Rand. So I'm not putting him down. I'm just saying socialism is part of the government that we have today. It's not supposed to be, but it is. Communism is a different animal, and when people are overtly proclaiming themselves communist, when people are overtly coming out and running under the banner of the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, we have a communism problem. And I will say this for the orange man, and I don't have a lot of good for him to say right now, but at least someone in our government will fucking say it. Communism. These people are communists. And I'm kind of with Pinochet on what needs to happen with communists and helicopters and one-way trips. I'm just saying. These people are overt communists, and they're actually worse than communists. They're mentally ill communists. These are people that have lumped in their cause of communism, which is basically highly authoritarian, full socialism, okay, with the cause of things like free Palestine, gay rights, trans rights. These things are not compatible. This cultural Marxism is not just communism. It is a mental fucking illness. And this is a problem. And I will credit the orange man for having the stones to stand up and say, that's communism, and that's a problem, and that's what we should all be saying right now. Now, does that mean we give everybody a pass on their bullshit? No. But there is no doubt your biggest enemy right now is within your own country. It's not China. It's not Russia. It's not Iran, right? It's not any other country you dig up. It's not Cuba. It's the communists and the lunatic left in your own country. And everything else, no matter how bad it is less bad than that for the long-term trajectory of our nation. Every nation that falls into full-scale communism goes exactly this way. The causes, the grievances, the lunacy that gets drummed up, the debauchery that gets drummed up, that may change. But in the end, well, I'll have a segment for you on my new Monday show, How Do You Sell Communism to People? And I think it'll make sense, so I'll wait till then to talk more about it. But communism is a problem, and let's not soften it with socialism. I know that they're flavors of the same thing, right? It's like ice cream and gelato or some shit, right? But full-scale communism, and when you have people openly proclaiming themselves this, advocating this and running with success for government in a country like the United States, Orange Man's right. We have a big fucking problem, and we should all be saying it. Moving on, let's talk about something else. Shrooms, and not the kind that get you all seeing the walls breathe. The ones we eat. Lion's mane, oyster mushrooms, things like that. Chef Ken did a great segment last show about this. Getting the water out of them and some other things. Now we're going to move on to full-scale cooking of our mushrooms and not making rubber balls out of them.
Hello all, Chef Ken here with part two of Cooking Mushrooms and the final answer for Jerry, who asked the original question. So, now we've done everything we reasonably can before cooking. We've managed the storage, we've dried the surface, maybe we've experimented with the refrigerator, the air fryer, freezing and thawing, and even tearing the mushrooms apart instead of slicing them. We've tried to get some water out before the mushrooms ever see the heat. So, now what? Now we have to cook them. And this is where I think a lot of people undo all the work they just did. Jerry's original question was specifically about blue oyster mushrooms, pink oyster mushrooms, and lion's manes coming out rubbery. The first thing I want is a large pan. Stainless steel is great. Cast iron is my preference. But what I don't want is a little 8-inch skillet filled to the brim with mushrooms. If you crowd the pan, all of the water we've been talking about has nowhere to go. The mushrooms release moisture, the moisture turns to steam, the steam gets trapped between all those little mushrooms, and you've essentially built a little steam room, and that's exactly what we're trying to avoid. I'd rather cook two batches properly than one big batch poorly. I get the pan hot. Medium-high heat is usually where I want to be. I need enough energy to evaporate water quickly, but I also want enough control that when the pan finally dries out, I don't immediately scorch everything. I don't start with butter. I'm putting the mushrooms dry into the pan. Now, I listen to them. And this is something I wish more people learned to do in the kitchen. Stop staring at the clock and start paying attention to what the food is telling you. When the mushrooms first hit the pan, you'll hear them begin to hiss. As they heat up and release water, that sound becomes wetter. I know that's a bad way to describe that, but it sounds like there's more water in the pan. And depending on the mushrooms, you might actually see liquid pooling in the bottom of the skillet. That's fine. Let that water come out and evaporate. And if there's enough room in the pan, move those mushrooms around occasionally so everything heats up evenly, but don't stand there nervously stirring every 3 seconds. Give the heat time to work. Eventually, that liquid will begin to disappear. This is one of those moments in cooking where your ears can sometimes tell you what's happening before your eyes do. The sound of wet mushroom simmering begins changing into the sharper sound of food actually frying against hot metal. That's the transition we're looking for. Now I start thinking about fat, and this is where the butter finally becomes useful. Butter at the beginning can become part of the liquid you're trying to cook away. Butter after the water has largely evaporated becomes cooking fat, a browning medium, and flavor. And that's a much better use of good butter. I usually add enough to coat the mushrooms rather than to drown them. So now we've entered a completely different stage of cooking. We're no longer trying to remove water. Now we're trying to build a crust. And this is where the three mushrooms Jerry's asked about begin to go in different directions. So let's start with the blue oysters. I really like blue oysters because once you figure them out, they're incredibly versatile. As I mentioned in the first segment, I prefer tearing them into pieces rather neatly than slicing them. Those irregular edges give me all those little places that can brown and crisp. And then after the initial dry cook has driven off the water, I'll add butter and spread the mushrooms back across the pan, and then I leave them alone. And that's super important. If you keep flipping the mushrooms, they never spend enough uninterrupted time against the metal to develop good color. Once I've got that color, I'll toss them and expose the other side and continue cooking until I've got a combination of textures. I want some crisp edges, some brown surfaces, and a center that still has a little bit of tenderness. Salt, black pepper, butter, shallot, thyme, maybe a little more lemon at the end, and that's plenty. Let it taste like a damn mushroom. Do not over-season it. Pink oysters require a slightly different method. First, however you're getting them, they're absolutely beautiful. And understandably, you probably want to keep that pink color, but it's probably not going to survive the cooking process, and that's normal. Once I've gotten through the water release stage, I'll add my fat. I'll let the mushrooms really develop some color. And I'm not trying to burn them either. I'm just not afraid of the brown, right? That's the difference. Pink oysters can get these wonderfully crisp and almost brittle edges, while the thicker portions kind of remain very savory and tender. And that's the texture contrast I want. If I were putting pink oysters over like a creamy polenta grits, I'd probably take them further than if I was just going to put them into a sauce. I want those crisp edges surviving when they hit whatever they're being served with. Okay, so then we get into lion's mane, and lion's mane is the one that gets people the most. Everybody hears the comparison to like crab or lobster, and they get this mushroom, and they put butter in a skillet, and they throw the whole dang thing in there, and 10 minutes later, it's a mess. Lion's mane needs patience. And if you got a beautifully large specimen, I don't necessarily want to shred the entire thing. I'll tear or cut it into thick slabs or larger pieces. And I want enough thickness that I can develop serious browning on the outside without drying the interior to oblivion. Lion's mane can release an impressive amount of water. Let it. If you're cooking thick pieces, this is where pressing becomes useful. I'll use a grill press or a bacon press or even another skillet and gently press the lion's mane against the hot surface. I am not looking to smash it. What I'm trying to do is increase the contact between the mushroom and the pan while encouraging some of that moisture to leave. You'll sometimes see liquid come out around the edges as you press. That is good. That's exactly what I want. Let that liquid evaporate. Then release the pressure, give the mushrooms a little time, flip it, and repeat the process. Once that water has largely stopped coming out, that's when I'll add butter and ingredients. And let me tell you, lion's mane loves butter. That mushroom has lost a lot of water. The surface is hot, and instead of creating a pale butter and water bath, now you're using butter to help build this deep golden exterior. Now I'll usually add again thyme because I love thyme with mushrooms. Sometimes a little bit of smashed garlic clove, and I'll spoon that butter over the mushrooms just like I might baste a steak. And that's where the comparison to shellfish starts making sense. Not because lion manes magically taste like a damn lobster, but because the combination of these fibrous textures, moisture, butter, and this browning can remind you of that experience. As quick as I can, Jerry, that is about the best way I can describe mushrooms that you asked for. I know it's longer than I expected, but really, it's moisture management. Keep sending all your questions in to BloodSugarChef.com. Until next time, this is Ken, your Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
Yeah, I'm going to just add a little bit on the pink oysters here in that there's a couple things to know. One, like, just don't even bother with stem. In fact, I think you need to come up the fan maybe a quarter inch and just from there nub it off with those with a knife, because their stems are like wood. And so a lot of oysters, goldens, blues, the stems are actually, in my opinion, one of the better parts of the mushroom. Especially some of the blues, they get really nice stems on them. But the pinks, again, it's like a woody stick. So just eliminate those. Two, like you said, you want to keep the color, but you're not gonna. About the only way I've been able to do pinks and keep maybe 25% of the tone is a light pickle. So what I'm talking about, instead of like a 3-to-1 vinegar where you're 3 parts vinegar to 1 part water, or a 2-to-2 where you're half and half, or 1-to-1, I guess you'd say as well if you reduced it, you're more like a 1-to-4. Like 20-25% of a neutral vinegar, like a white vinegar, to water, and then whatever other seasonings you want to add into your pickle brine. Some salt, obviously, is good. And those make a really great, like, thing for like a canapé, like a one bite appetizer, and they do retain some pink, but not very much. The pink just cooks out of them, and they're really not great raw. So yeah, worry about the quality of the food, not the color of the food in this particular instance. And I will say, on lion's mane, one of the best things I've ever eaten is lion's mane mushroom, cooked kind of the way that he said. I've also done lion's mane using some Old Bay seasoning and butter, kind of at the end, at that final sear where you're taking some of the flavor back into the mushroom after you push the water out. It's pretty freaking good. And I'm not going to say, a lot of people say, like, it tastes just like crab meat or whatever. I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say that it tastes more like crab meat than mushroom, though. Anyway, let's continue to roll forward in today's show. Today we're going to also hear from Doc Mullins, who we haven't heard much from lately. He's got a good segment for us on smoke inhalation today.
Hi, Joel and MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net. New York Times best-selling co-author of the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at AltonFirstAid.com. With many wildfires in the western U.S. and Canada out of control and more reported daily, it's clear that this is going to be a very, very active fire season. Tens of thousands have been forced to evacuate their homes, and more than 1,000 structures have been destroyed. Although deaths have been few so far, air quality is poor in the fire areas and even far downwind. That makes smoke inhalation injuries a possibility in some places. Now, you might be surprised to know that the greatest immediate threat in wildfires is rarely the flames themselves. More people die from smoke inhalation than from burns. For the family medic, knowing how to identify and treat this type of injury is essential. Now, many believe that the ambulance is always right around the corner and the rescue helicopter is no more than a few minutes away. In natural disasters like wildfires and floods, however, medical personnel may be unable to reach those that are in need. In these situations, rapid recognition and intervention by those at the scene, that can mean the difference between life and death. Smoke is a complex mixture of gases, particulate matter, and chemical toxins produced by something called incomplete combustion. Incomplete combustion occurs when a fuel burns in a limited supply of oxygen. This leads to the production of harmful byproducts. Common components include carbon monoxide, hydrogen cyanide, nitrogen oxides, and a host of toxic particles. The exact composition varies depending on exactly what's burning. Is it plastics, treated wood, synthetic fabrics, petroleum products? These are especially dangerous. In a long-term survival setting, a poorly ventilated wood stove or a brush fire can pose the same health hazards. So how does inhaling smoke kill you? The damage occurs through three main mechanisms. One, heat and toxic gases injure the upper airway, causing swelling that can rapidly obstruct breathing. Two, carbon monoxide binds to red blood cells far easier than oxygen does, and that reduces the blood's ability to carry oxygen to vital organs. And three, fine particles and chemical irritants penetrate deep into the lungs, triggering inflammation, fluid accumulation, and later, possibly infection. Serious exposure can produce respiratory failures even hours after the victim appears to have safely escaped the fire. Symptoms often begin with coughing. Also, you might see watery eyes and a sore throat. Victims may report signs of early carbon monoxide poisoning, such as headache, dizziness, nausea, or confusion. Hoarseness, facial burns, and stridor, a high-pitched sound on inhalation, are seen if there is an airway injury. Soot in the nostrils or mouth, that's another red flag. In severe cases, the patient becomes cyanotic, turns blue in other words, restless, and perhaps even loses consciousness. Symptoms can worsen over the next 24 to 48 hours as swelling and inflammation progresses. A person only mildly affected at the scene may later develop life-threatening respiratory distress. So how do you treat smoke inhalation? In an austere environment, the medic must transport the victim from the smoke-filled area and into fresh air. That's essential, right? If the victim is unconscious and not breathing, you want to open the airway and begin rescue breathing or bag valve mask ventilation if you happen to have one. High-flow oxygen is the mainstay of treatment, but off the grid, pure oxygen, well, that may not be an option. It's important to know that even room air is better than continued exposure to smoke. You want to assess the victim's airway carefully. You want to look for singed nostril hairs, soot, facial burns, or worsening hoarseness. These findings indicate a high risk that obstruction is going to develop. In a modern ER, a breathing tube would be placed pretty early in these cases. That's not likely to be available, so keep the patient calm, elevate the head of the bed or litter, and prepare for the possibility of performing a tracheotomy if a complete obstruction develops. The procedure is described in our website at doomandbloom.net and also in our book, The Survival Medicine Handbook, The Essential Guide for When Help is Not on the Way. The family medic should support breathing by encouraging coughing to clear secretion. If the patient can drink, small sips of water may help keep that airway moist. Monitor closely for an increasing respiratory rate or use of accessory neck muscles to breathe or declining mental status. Antibiotics, well, usually they're not needed for smoke inhalation alone, but secondary pneumonia may develop over the following days. You want to watch closely for fever and increased amounts of phlegm. Carbon monoxide poisoning deserves special mention here. In the absence of laboratory testing, assume significant exposure has occurred if the patient was in a closed space with a lot of smoke or if their mental status is altered. Off the grid, fresh air, and rest, they're the only practical treatments available. Avoid any activity that increases oxygen demand until the patient improves. This may take at least a few weeks. Of course, prevention remains the most effective strategy. In a homesteader retreat, install and maintain working smoke detectors if you have power. Keep fire extinguishers charged and accessible, and design wood stoves and heating systems with proper ventilation. In normal times when the air quality is poor, you can protect yourself also by staying indoors with the windows closed. Turn the air conditioner on, though, because most central air conditioning systems don't pull air from the outside. They cool and recirculate the air already inside your home. You may also use a HEPA filter, that is a high-efficiency particulate air filter, that may help also. During wildfire season, you want to prepare for rapid evacuation and have N95 or better masks available for short-term use in smoky air. Teach family members the stop, drop, and roll technique and the importance of staying low under smoke. Remember, the concentration of smoke is less the lower you go. If venturing into a smoke-dense environment, be sure to wear personal protection gear. A rescuer who becomes a casualty helps nobody. For the group medic, smoke inhalation is a reminder that environmental injuries often outnumber classic burn trauma. Stocking simple airway supplies, knowing how to recognize a progressive obstruction, and practicing basic respiratory support will serve the group well. In long-term disaster settings, knowledge and preparation remain the most reliable tools in the medical woodshed. This is Joe Alden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about over 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. Plus, get your family medically prepared with quality medical kits and individual supplies from AldenFirstAid.com. You'll be glad you did.
You know, we do try to come at everything on the Survival Podcast from two angles. One, what we do in, let's say, peacetime, and two, what we do in wartime. Not necessarily peace and war, but normal times, and like what Bones called austere times, like when there is no higher level of help. But the reality here with this injury is it is highly more likely that you will deal with it yourself or with someone you're trying to help during what we would call normal or somewhat normal times. In other words, there is a higher level of care. And kind of about one third into it, he hit on something that is so important to understand about smoke inhalation injuries. A person can experience a smoke inhalation injury. They can get out into, you know, fresh air. They can breathe and they can say they feel fine. And they can. And hours or a day later, they can literally go into acute distress and die very, very quickly. There's a lot of shit that people are like, you need to go to the hospital and get checked out. No, you don't. This is not one of those. This is, if you have any smoke inhalation, you need higher level medical care if it's available. Because just because you think you're okay doesn't mean that you are. There's some other things like that. I'm not saying this is the only one. It's just some things with chemical exposure and stuff like that can work that way as well. You know, but there's a lot of shit, you know, like a guy gets scraped up on a bicycle wreck, doesn't hit his head, and, oh, you go to a hospital. No, you don't. You know, you could, you ain't broken bones. Can you walk? Did you hit your head? No. Yeah, probably. Did you have any severe, like, abdominal injury or anything? No. Okay, you're probably fine. Like, people know when they've had serious concussive injury, the body, head, face, like, you feel it. Smoke is one of those things, like certain chemical exposures as well. And smoke is basically a chemical exposure. It's what it is. It's internal. And I've personally seen this happen to somebody where they thought they were completely fine. And then, fortunately, they didn't die. But, I mean, it was a matter of, like, the fact this person was talked into going is why they're still here. Like that level of danger. So this is a very serious one. I'm glad. I'm surprised in 18 years, first time we talked about it, really. Other than some shows on fire and stuff and getting out, but not the exposure. Thank you, Bones, for that. Plug the hole for us. 18 years, you thought we wouldn't need it, but we did. Now we're going to talk about technology on the homestead from a few different angles. Kind of a grab bag from Ryan Steva, the Homestead Consultant.
Hey, TSP community. This is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today, I've got a grab bag of things that I'm interested in, because I figured if I'm interested in them, this community probably would be as well. So I've got four things I think are interesting that are useful for self-sovereignty as well as preparedness and security. So I think they fit well with the program as well. The first one I want to mention is actually long-range trail cams. Now, one of the things that I didn't mention in the last segment that was aired is the idea of using trail cams for security cameras. And I actually think it's a really great option for the given situation. It wasn't a great option because Wi-Fi doesn't reach very far, and even with extenders or a mesh system, you have some major limitations. And the other issue that I have is a lot of the Wi-Fi trail cams just don't seem to do a good job sending data back, and they can become kind of convoluted as well. So I didn't mention them for a few reasons, but when Jack mentioned them, it actually made me think maybe there's some new options out there that I have not looked at yet. And sure enough, there are some super long range Wi-Fi based trail cams, but they're not Wi-Fi to the trail cam. How it works is they have a base station, and the base station then talks on a different frequency to the devices. Now, I can nerd out and tell you which IEEE number it is. That's probably not real helpful, but basically one of the systems is a proprietary RF mesh, and the other is a, it's technically, I guess, considered Wi-Fi, but it's called Hollow, H-A-L-O-W, and that is a lower frequency or a 900 megahertz band bandwidth. So these will work without any cloud connection or cloud service. There's no monthly fee or anything else. And the other really cool thing with trail cams is they also save the data on SD cards at the trail camera, and they will relay that information back to your phone or computer or email or however you want it to relay to you. The two primary brands that I found that I feel comfortable roughly recommending have a little bit different systems. So the one is called Grade Pro, one word, and specifically these long-range Wi-Fi ones are one part of their lineup, and they're called the Link 1.0. And those can go up to 3,000 feet line of sight. And in typical situations, you should be able to expect them to get about 1,600 feet. The other brand is Cuddleback or Cuddlelink. Again, one word for each of those. And they have a proprietary mesh system. And the reason this is really cool is you can go up to 2+ miles in open settings because you can piggyback one camera to the next. And so you can put one camera half the distance and then the next camera the whole distance that you want to get from your home. And they'll talk to each other to relay messages back. All right, the next item in my grab bag is I built a troubleshooting custom GPT, and I'm going to leave the link with Jack so that you guys, if you've got the paid version of GPT, you can actually just go to that link, and anything you want to troubleshoot, it'll help you do it. I've set it up very specifically, so it will guide you through the first couple of questions to determine how comfortable you are with the troubleshooting of the given thing, how comfortable you are with working on the given thing, and what the best approach for you is, how much information you want to know about the reasoning for the way that it's troubleshooting and the questions that it's asking, or if you want it to just get straight to the point. But I've set it up based on some of my troubleshooting experience and the ways that I do it, and I think it could really help people either learn how to troubleshoot or get through troubleshooting something very quickly. I have found it extremely useful to be able to throw this customer GPT at a problem where I understand how to troubleshoot, but I don't know the system itself that I'm troubleshooting very well. And so, for example, I could tell it an issue that I'm having with my vehicle, and it can help walk me through and narrow down the possibilities and then tell me what the likelihood of the different possibilities are. So I'm putting that out to the public, free to use for whoever wants to use the link. I'll include that for Jack. The next grab bag item is something called Project Nomad, and this has been dubbed the offline internet. And there's some really cool things about it. One is that it's got a built-in local LLM, and so you can actually give it a set of instructions or information, and you can use it much more like notebook LLM as opposed to your standard large language model. So rather than it referencing its source material or the material that it already has been trained on, what it does is it uses that training and then it only references the material you pointed at. So I thought that was really cool. You can actually even build out multiple different libraries with different types of books in it and talk to the given LLM or point it at the right file and tell it, pull your information from this file. It also stores the entirety of Wikipedia in a searchable and information-based way so that you can access it offline, as well as training manuals, videos, all kinds of other things. And it's all accessible from your local network by any device. If you want to pull it up on your phone or your computer or your laptop, whatever you want to use, you can actually pull it up and you can install this for free. It's an open source project. So you can download it, install it for free on hardware that you already have, like a laptop or an old gaming PC or something else that you may, a mini PC that you have laying around, and you can use it as an offline reference system. And then finally in my grab bag, the last one here is actually StartOS. Now, Start9 is a sponsor of Jack's show, and they're an awesome sponsor. And if you need hardware, especially if you need any type of support, go through them, buy an actual server, like an Embassy server or whatever, and you'll get a lot more support. But for weirdos and nerds like me who like to tinker with things, you can actually download the StartOS and you can install it on your own hardware. So a laptop that you've got sitting around, again, an old gaming PC, mini PC is actually what I'm running my StartOS on. And so you can download it. It's open source free software that the organization has put out for free for everybody to use. And you can download it as an ISO and or an image file and then actually write it to a computer. And so I use my StartOS for all kinds of sovereign things. One of the big ones is uploading all my pictures and videos to it from my smartphone instead of using, say, Google Drive. And it works amazing. So anyways, if you're nerdy like me and like to tinker, you can actually install StartOS on basically most relatively modern x86 platforms. So that's my grab bag. I hope people find that interesting and there's something within that for everybody. And hopefully it brings up more questions. If you have other questions, send them my way. I'd love to answer them. Otherwise, have a great week.
Great, great segment. And honestly, we might want to have Ryan come back on the air sometime as a guest and go through more stuff like this, or maybe I should do a standalone show, or, you know, we could get our resident tech expert, Jesse Markowitz, on to talk about things like what we can do with Start9 that Ryan mentioned a little bit there, specifically angled toward this instead of just more at what we think of as the typical tech layer. So there's a lot that could be explored here, maybe several shows or even a series with that. On that, I do have four links that Ryan provided, and they are all in the show notes for today under his bullet point as sub-bullets. All right, next up, we got Andy McCann talking about how do we get a spouse on board with fitness? And he's talking about specifically in this question with like working out, doing exercise. But I find that this one is much more broad. I think it's important to exercise. I think the food we put in our body is the most important indicator of where our health is going to head, though, even more so than exercise. In fact, I think when we eat healthy, we're going to be somewhat physically active anyway. And I think the two are very mixed. So I'm going to put a pin in that, and I'll come back and say a little bit after Andy talks before I move on to my segment for today.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own a CrossFit garage and have been in the health and fitness business for, I don't know, like 20-something years. Anyway, I am a degreed engineer that loves problem solving. And the problem I saw was that as we get older, we tend to just do badly. So men in their 50s, we enter the drop-dead years. And I thought, well, I would like to solve this. I'm an engineer that likes tackling problems. What do I do? So anyway, years later, I end up with a gym and I help people live longer and become harder to kill. So the question came up, and I love this. It was basically, Andy, I'm working with Coach Josiah from your gym remotely, and I would like to get my spouse to come along for the journey. How do I do that? And man, the answer is so complicated. I wish I could just tell you, put a shock collar on them, invite them or force them to come, and then they'll just work out with you. It doesn't work like that. I own a gym. I have two of my kids enjoyed CrossFit. One of them actually has graduated from college and come back and now is a coach with me. The other four in my family now have faded away to do other stuff, and sometimes it's not really anything. And, I mean, I have a gym. It's free, and I can't motivate them to do what I think they should do. So here's what I would go with and where I've landed. Anything is better than nothing. Something, get them to do something or praise the something they're doing. The something could be, hey, I'm tracking my steps. Beautiful. As an example, I would love it if everyone in my family did CrossFit. You know that. But they don't. My wife's choice of working out, she's got a couple things, but one of them is she tracks her steps. And I praise that regularly because movement is better than nothing. Tracking allows them to measure. So if your family member, let's just, in this case, we're going to go with wife because I'm going to go down that road. Let's just say your wife. It could be anybody in your family. So your wife, if she does anything, praise it, build it up, say, I'm so proud of you. What I have learned is no one wants you to solve their problems unless they ask. So wait for them to ask. If they're not going to ask, just praise the things they're doing and continue to do your thing. They will see what's going on, but you cannot force them to do it. Now, walking is good. Counting their steps is good. If they do anything else, Levi wants to get big. He is now 6 feet tall. He's in college and he's like, Dad, I can pretty much eat pixie stick, you know, those sticks full of sugar and grow muscles. I'm like, yeah, that's what happens when you're in that 17 to 22 year old range as a male. She says, I want to be big. He's doing something to get big. He's doing hypertrophy. That's, you know, the standard dude thing we've done forever, which is on Monday, back and by, Tuesday, chest and try, and Wednesday is leg day. Now, he doesn't skip leg day, and he actually squats to full depth because he knows CrossFit. But I praise him for that. He's doing something. And you're like, well, Andy, he is doing something. My spouse, my wife in this case, is doing absolutely nothing. What do I do? Man, it is tough. You cannot force them to do it. The thing that I would give you is this. Most people come to us in the gym once they had a come to Jesus moment. So if time is your crunch, I just don't have time for it. CrossFit is the biggest hack in health and fitness when it comes to time and other stuff. So they come to me and they say, hey, the doctor just said, and that's usually, or I just had kids or something like that. There was a change in their life. And that's what you're looking for. That's unfortunate, right? It's like a come to Jesus moment. I was in a car accident. I saw my life flash before me. I decided I need to, whatever, believe and all that stuff, right? So sometimes that has to happen. So a way you could do it, not sneaky and, you know, deceitful or anything like that, but you could set up a doctor appointment or like with a medical facility that's not a, not a hospital, like so one of those boutique places where they do like a DEXA scan or a full body scan or one of these other things. There are tests you can do outside of the insurance racket in the hospital world to just get an idea of how you are doing health-wise. If you need help finding that, email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com. We will narrow it down on your area and find a thing that you guys could do at low cost. And that'd give you at least some markers of like, hey, look at that. Our blood work isn't as awesome as we thought. Maybe we should do something. Like you can do one of those Any Labs or Quest Labs and just do the blood work. So they have a like a male panel and a female panel, and you could do those things and you can measure it against the norm. And they'll actually give you a really cool color coordinated sheet that might put them into overdrive. Like, for example, I just had a guy come to the gym and say, apparently I'm not as healthy as I thought I was. And the story was about taking the kids up Stone Mountain. It's a big rock here in Georgia that people go up. I mean, it's a super huge rock. It's massive. And So, again, there is a thing that happens in their life, and that's usually what brings them to change. I mean, talk about, like, this stuff with Jack. How do I get my spouse to start doing prepping, to care about carrying a gun and all that stuff? Man, you can't force him. You can go back and listen to all his messages. It's basically be supportive, praise the things that they are doing, and just be there when they do ask the questions. Yes, I have a gym, and only two of us actually use it. Two of my other kids pay for a membership somewhere else. And sometimes it's just not dad, right? So there's that advice you can give when a kid's, I don't know, playing soccer or like gymnastics and baseball. And you're like, hey, Brylan, if you did this, you probably, and they're like, no. And then the coach says the exact same thing. And they're like, wow, that is the best advice I have ever heard. And that's just, you know, what is the thing? Like, no prophet has honor in his hometown or something. So they just don't want to hear it from you. We do that all the time with our summer strength. The kids come in and I tell them, hey, if you do your homework, it creates responsibility for lifting. Like, wow, if you eat your protein, that'll help build muscle with this lifting. And the parents are like, I can't believe that worked. So yes, it is true. That stuff does work. Okay. Go easy on them. Do not be a salesman. Be a guide to go along with the journey. Invite, don't pressure. It won't happen because you said the words and they're like, oh, that is such a great argument. That's never going to happen. I take that back. Unless you're married to like Rain Man, it's not going to happen. So you need to be available and catch them when they're ready. Yes, you can create the opportunity of ready by some health tests. Or maybe sign up for like, hey, would you like to do a 3K, 5K, 1K type jog run? And so they can get an idea. Sometimes it's just that they don't express their health and fitness, so they don't understand how far they've fallen because they're comparing to all the other bad people out there, right? Okay, guys, hey, if you need more help, you can find me at CrossFitGarage.com or you can listen to my podcast, Fitness, Food, and Finance. Talk to you guys next week.
You know what? I'll add on to what Andy said about getting a spouse on board with like, a diet or exercise routine of any kind is what I talk about when I talk to people about homeschooling. And something that was said to us when we started our homeschooling journey with our grandchildren by Sue LaPreeze. And what she told my wife, and this was like the most pressure release valve thing that anybody ever did, I think, for my wife during the whole homeschool period, you know, because we had to do it for COVID, because even here in Texas, they shut down the schools for about the last 6 weeks of the year in 2020, and then we decided to go forward with it, and my wife put a lot of pressure on herself, and what Sue said was, Dorothy, let me explain this to you. You cannot make a child learn a thing that they do not wish to learn, okay? And then the second thing was, and you can't prevent them from learning something once they've decided they want to learn it. And that was like, you know, like the graphic with the guy like with a space behind his head going, like mind-blowing. So simple, but so true. This is a pattern that repeats itself, and it's not just with children, it's with adults. I can't force an adult to learn a thing they don't want to learn. In fact, it's more difficult. A child may not yet be aware of this fact that they don't have to learn a thing, and they may feel so compelled by pressure that they'll bite the bullet and do it through compliance. But an adult is like, F you. I don't care about this. You're not my boss. Piss off, right? Well, that's true of many things. You're not going to get a person to eat in a way that they don't want to eat. Until, like Andy said, some sort of come to Jesus moment happens, right? They may even do it to get you to shut up, and then they're just going to go eat differently when you're not watching. And the same with exercise and many other things. I basically completely agree with his take on this, but what I'll add is keep doing your thing. Keep doing your thing. And then also be okay with the fact that your spouse may decide they want to take a different path than you. And I think he kind of inferred that as well. My wife sometimes asks me to go. She's a member of Planet Fitness, and I exercise. I don't want to go there. I don't want my day disrupted. I like to exercise first thing in the morning. That's what I like to do. And I like to do things my way. I'm not big on machines and shit like that. Like, I want to go hit the heavy bag. You know, I'll power walk my property 3 laps. You know, that's a couple miles or something like that. Like, things like that. That's what I want to do. And it's okay that you guys do different things. I think it's actually very important that couples, especially as you mature and kids begin to leave the home and grow up and have their own lives, have time together and have things of their own. I think that's really important. But I will tell you that Nagging doesn't work. And pushing someone to do a thing that they're resistant to, let's say the resistance is at 5%. You would think at 5%, that little nudge would just push them over. Okay. You shutting your mouth and going and demonstrating that it makes your life better, that's a great nudge for the last 5%. You push 5%, it becomes 10%. You push 10%, it becomes 20%. The harder you push on a thing, the more resistant the person you're pushing on will become to it. It doesn't matter what it is. This goes back to my sales days. I always trained my salespeople, yes, push back on objections, answer questions, because those are buying opportunities. You know, those are buying, any question's a buying question, right? But don't push hard and don't be a pain in the ass. Because if you make it easy to say no, you are more likely to get a yes than if you make it hard to say no. When you push people into a position where they feel like they're cornered, they resist you. Think of it like picking a stray dog up off the road. So you find the stray dog, he's really, really hungry, and you manage to get him in your car, and you take him home to your house, and then you get some food in a bowl, and he kind of slinks away from you, and he goes back in a corner, and you go up in his face in the corner, and you shove the food up and say, "Eat it!" He's going to bite your face, right? He's going to bite your face. You made it hard to say no. He feels trapped. No being likes to feel contained and trapped. And so he's going to bite you. Yeah, I'm going to an extreme here, but there's a point to it. If I put the food on the floor and I walk away and I don't give a shit if he eats it and he's hungry enough, he's going to sniff it. He's going to look around. He's going to feel a little bit, this is, I don't know about this place, but eventually he's probably going to take a bite of it. Hey, that's pretty good. And he's going to start eating it. And all of a sudden, I'm going to have a best friend, which we always want our spouses to be. Okay? This is the approach you have to take with this. You can offer the invitation, but never push. And don't criticize the inaction, because that will cause them to put on like a force field. And then things that you say that don't even have anything to do with it will be perceived as having to do with it and create even more resistance. So that's my little add-on there. And if you want to go back and listen to episode 69 of the Survival Podcast, a lot of the same philosophy is in that, though it's about prepping. And it is over, 17 years ago that I did that show. All right, now, let's talk about my topic today. I think it's a really interesting topic. If you haven't paid attention, a federal judge ruled, like last week, that the federal government, under the current situation that we're under, where they removed the tax cost to apply for an SBR, okay, or a suppressor. I don't like the word silencer because it's not what they do, but either of those things, because there's not a charge for it anymore, then the federal government has no authority over it anymore. The DOJ, that's the Department of Justice, then was the sole authority that could appeal that decision. So this is not like somebody being sued or something, right? This is a case in which a person was, you have to have these things, and I believe in the, and this is important, that Gun Owners of America was part of this case, in fact, I think it was a lawsuit, but it was a lawsuit against the government, right? So only the government can appeal it. You can't get some left-wing think tank out of California to appeal this, is what I'm getting at. But Gun Owners of America, Palmetto State Armory, were part of this case. And the judge said that the federal government has no authority here at all, because since the justification for the NFA was the tax, because the government had the power to tax, and that was an admission the government did not have a power to restrict these items. And case law since the NFA has only strengthened that position with things like common use and things like that. No. This is groundless. Then the DOJ and the ATF, et cetera, you do something about it, right? And they didn't. So after 7 days, that basically becomes de facto law. But it ain't clear what it means yet. And the judge still has to issue his final opinion, which will fill in things like, okay, does that mean only people that buy from Palmetto State Armory and are members of Gun Owners of America are free to do this, or does that mean everybody? And I know you're thinking, oh, no, 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 Jack, you're not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't claim to know shit here. That's my point. No, you don't know that, okay? That's just stage one. And I'm not even going to name states here because you need to know your local laws, right? But say you're in a state that has no state-level prohibition on SBRs or on suppressors. A state that had no additional regulations, laws, or restrictions. Theoretically, now you should be able to just go buy one. Do you have to do a 4140? Well, it's not a firearm for the suppressor, but some states are saying it, some states are not. It's weird. This is new and we don't know. Okay? I would say that right now it may still be beneficial to obtain the federal permit without the cost and wait the little bit of extra time to do it because of some other things that I'm about to say, even if your state doesn't seem to be a problem right now. Because here's the other side of this problem. It is appearing that what's going to happen next is the federal government's going to stop issuing these altogether. If you have no authority, then how do you have the authority to issue? Okay. There are states, again, I'm not going to name them. You need to track down law for yourself. I do not want to be the reason you screwed up and committed a felony and you blame me for it. But there are states where the state says, okay, you can have this, but you have to also register with us. We have these additional restrictions, and you have to first obtain the federal permit, and then you can get whatever it is we say that you need. But that state is heavily leaning on the federal process. In other words, the state, let's call it liberaltopia, that is not full on lunatic and trying to prevent it altogether because there's states that say you can't do it still. What they think is, okay, well, this person went through this process. They submitted fingerprints and all. Basically, we already know that they're good to go, and we have access to the federal database. And therefore, simply by plugging into our database, and we can access this federal database, we can track. And that's what it's really all about for us. Okay, but now Bill gets the silencer or the SBR or the suppressor in, you know, Liberaltopia State. And the state now says, well, you can't because there's no federal process for you to go through. If you live in one of those states and you're like right, you're right about to do it, you may want to do it and get the permit while you can. Here's an analogy for this. So the state of Vermont, basically, you could just carry a handgun. You don't need a permit. As reciprocity agreements began to form, people from Vermont were like, but I'm going to Florida. I want to carry my gun. Like, we have reciprocity. But you don't have a permit, so reciprocity doesn't apply. If the state you're going to says you can carry with a permit from another state that's part of reciprocity, but you have to have a permit from one of those states, and you're in New Hampshire. So New Hampshire started doing permits solely not because you needed one in New Hampshire, but so you could have reciprocity. It's kind of like that. There's some of these states where it may be illegal to own one of these two items, SBR or suppressor, or one, not the other. One may remain completely illegal in that state, and one may become legal with the federal exemption, but with additional steps, but now the federal thing's gone. You see, it's just a mess. This is not clean. It's good, but it's a mess, and it's going to create, I believe, a series of fights. Now, there are some states, I think you're in good standing if you just go get one by whatever they say you need to do now, okay? But you really, 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 on top of really need to be careful with it. I'll give you another analogy just to really drive home the state enforcement issue. There's zero federal prohibition, for instance, on carrying a knife with a 6-inch blade. There's no now, there might be in D.C. or something like that. What I mean is, if you are carrying a knife, let's say a 5-inch blade knife in the state of Texas, you're completely legal to do that, right? There are some things about daggers and stupid shit like that in the Texas knife code that's dumb. Very few people are ever prosecuted for it. It's almost always punitive prosecution. In other words, we got you, but we can't really make the case, but you had this thing too, so we're going to do it for this. But the person that just happened to have it is almost never prosecuted. Doesn't mean it can't happen, right? But a 5-inch lockback, typically like a buck 110, right? Totally legal in the state of Texas. there are other states where that knife is too long for everyday carry. That blade is considered to be an illegal blade to carry in that state. I think it's stupid, but it is illegal. I think Massachusetts would fall under that. In neither of those states is carrying any knife going to be something that's going to bring a federal charge on you, unless it was like an accompanying weapons charge. Like, you had the knife while in commission of a federal crime and a prosecutor's trying to stack it. But walking around on the street with that knife in either state, no federal officer would ever arrest you and ask a prosecutor to bring charges against you. But in one state, you're fine. In the other state, it's a freaking state felony. This is a state felony is very serious, right? It is life-altering forever. So you have to take this into consideration just because, or think of cannabis, right? The federal prohibition on cannabis drastically changed. I'm not going to say it totally went away, but it drastically changed. And in some states, you can go get, you know, a little stamp or something and go to a dispensary and buy all the pot you want. In other states, you can almost just go buy all the pot you want without doing much of anything. In other states, you go to jail. You go to prison. It's a felony over a certain amount. So state law doesn't supersede federal law as being more powerful or having a higher level in the hierarchy, or the word I'm thinking is supremacy. State law is not supreme to federal law when they're in conflict, but when there's an absence of federal law, state law is law. So the only thing that could happen here that would change that is if the federal government turned around and somehow passed a law through Congress that said you can't prohibit these things. Now, here's some of the legal fights, and you got to be careful when people start talking about this because they may be correct, but it may not help you, right? So you look at Heller, D.C., and like, is it in common use, right? And if it's in common use, you can actually say, well, not if it's a common use with the firearm, it's not just an accessory, it's part of a firearm, and there's a big legal case to be made for suppressors in that. Okay, and common use? Oh my God! Go to the National Firearms ATF page for the Firearms Act Division, okay, which is at ATF.gov, and go look. And at the bottom of that page, you'll see applications received versus processed over the years. And if you go back to like 2015, they received 307,000 applications and processed 308, probably some holdovers from the year before. In 2016, they received half a million, processed 379,000, right? That's pretty common, right? But let me get 2023, they received and processed just a hair over a million applications. In 2024, they received 1.1 million applications and processed 1.3 million applications. Again, holdovers from the prior year, actually meaning they processed more than they received in 2024. So, how are you going to ever say this is not a common use among with firearms? And I don't think you can. But these things take time, and there's a lot of YouTube attorneys, and they're not really attorneys, okay? Because if they did what they're doing, when I say YouTube attorneys, I'm mocking them in that a guy that actually had a law license that does what some of these people are doing, okay, they would get disbarred. They would lose their license. Yeah? So what I'm saying is what they'll say is, well, it's in common use, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter if a prosecutor in your state decides to prosecute you. It doesn't matter if 3 years down the road you're released and are like, oops, sorry, we were in conflict with the law. Your life's ruined. Right? Even if you get the conviction over it, your life's ruined. Yeah, I'm going to tell you right now, someone that's done it before, you don't want to spend one night in jail, let alone a couple weeks or a couple months or a couple years. You just don't. It is not a place that you ever want to find yourself. You know the Scared Straight programs? I think if they just took every kid at about 16, threw them in a jail cell overnight, our crime rate would go down. No big program, nobody yelling at them, no nothing like that. Just, you don't know when it's going to happen. It's going to be sometime in your 16th year. I'm not advocating to actually do this. I'm saying the net result would be a decline in crime. They just come and they grab you and they just put you in a normal cell for 12 hours overnight. That, and then they just let you go in the morning. Nobody threatens you. Nobody beats you up. Nobody says they're going to trade you for cigarettes. Nothing like that happens. No hazing. No. I think that alone, when that door goes bam, there's a, and I think actually less time is more effective because you don't have time to adapt to it. I think it would work. And so what I'm saying out of that is you don't want to do it. So you can celebrate this win, but I think that different people in different locations need to look at it differently. And for some people, it may be less of a win. In other words, there may be people that prior to this might have had to go through the bullshit and submit to the Fed ATF to be able to obtain a suppressor in their state, okay? But after this, once they stop processing, which it looks like they're going to do, it may become all but impossible until there's some state-level battle. And then here's an ironic twist. A silencer, a suppressor, is a tube with baffles in it. It reduces the volume of a gunshot. It does not make it go pew, 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 like it does on TV, unless you're talking like subsonic 22 long rifle or something like that, right? Okay, so it just reduces volume. And it is not a gun. It is not a firearm. It is a tube. Some of the countries with the biggest restrictions on guns have no restrictions on silencers. You can go to a hardware store and buy one in France. There are countries where it is considered rude to go to a firing range without one, right? They're encouraged. They're considered a personal safety device for hearing. Yeah. An SBR is a firearm. Some of these states that have prohibitions against silencers will stand on much firmer legal ground holding them than they will with SBRs. Because an SBR clearly falls under Heller decisions of the Second Amendment in common use. So you have to make the case, as a defender of liberty, that the silencer falls under, or the suppressor falls under 2A. But you have no, it's a burden of proof to those against it to explain why, just because the barrel's under 16 inches, it doesn't fall under 2A. So it's a really, real, really weird world that we're in right now. And, you know, and then it starts to cascade into, but what about the pistols, right? What about the pistols with the braces that are really, we all know they're SBRs, but they hit a loophole. What about forced reset triggers? Because this doesn't do anything, okay, for, you know, quote unquote machine guns, but a forced reset trigger isn't one. But can it be regulated at the state level? Is it under common use? Does it fall under Heller? This is uncharted territory. So this is my biggest advice. If you heard this today, you're like, woohoo! I'm going to get me a suppressor and an SBR with no stamps. Wait till next week. They'll still be there. Let some clarity come from this decision. Find out what's going on in your state. Find out every law that applies or could apply here. And then make your decisions. Do not rush into something just because you can now. With that, I will wrap up for the week with you guys. Remember, I will be here Monday for you in the coming weeks because we will be doing kind of that short form show on Mondays from now on, kind of like Jack off the clock or something. I don't know. Yeah, Jack after dark, but during the day. I don't know. But we're going to have some fun with that. And so I'll be back on Monday. You won't have to wait till Tuesday for it. And that will be a live stream. I'm going to do them as live streams. I see no reason not to. It's actually easier to do a live stream in many ways than it is to do a show like this where I'm recording it audio only. All thanks to StreamYard for that and changing things for podcasters really for the good forever. Again, I want to remind you, if you want to pick up an SBR or you want to pick up a suppressor, just give it a beat. Wait for some clarity. Please do it in a way where you're not going to get yourself into trouble. If you want to come meet me in West Virginia, Charleston, West Virginia, on the 29th, just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, scroll down under today's episode. I'm going to bump that post about that event up a little bit so that you can find it. I'm also going to bump up my post about the AI course, so they'll be right under today's episode, which, of course, is 3,882. So you can pull that up and take a look at that. Please consider picking up copies of my book and or books. If you're coming to Charleston, I just shipped 25 sets of them up to Roy Ramey, who set that speaking engagement up. I'll be selling them for $20. They're a book, so $40 for the set autographed, which is a little bit off of what you'd pay on Amazon for the hardcovers anyway. We also have that meetup. Come see us at the meetup. Got lots of stuff going on, and the AI course going on sale again right at the end of the month. I'll also announce the fall workshop will go on sale. I'll just look up the exact date here. Hold on. That's going to go on sale Saturday, September 19, 9 a.m. I always do it on a Saturday. I do it about 9 a.m. That way it's 7 in California, 10 in New York, so that anybody in the country, it's a reasonable hour to be up at. That always sells out really fast. The workshop itself is going to be the week of November 11th. And November 11th is actually the Wednesday of that month. So if I look ahead here, it's the 11 through 15 of November. That gives you a full week before we go to Thanksgiving. Feel 2 weeks before we go to Thanksgiving after that. So that works out this year where we didn't have to pull it back a week. I don't like putting it right up against Thanksgiving. So if you want to come, those are the dates to look at to make sure that you take your time off from work or whatever. Wednesday the 11th through Sunday the 15th. And those workshops, again, like if you can't get here till Thursday morning, it's no big deal. We have a really good time Wednesday. Wednesday's like, if you're a first-timer, you'll meet people and all, but if you've been a few times, it's kind of a reunion. Everybody's hugging and stuff when they show up. We throw a bunch of brats on the sausages on the grill, and we drink some beers, and we just set up camp and stuff like that and just hang out. Thursday morning is when we do the briefing, and everything actually kicks off. We have 3 days of presentations, about 5 presentations per day, so 15 total presentations. We video it all. We broadcast it. We live stream it. It's a lot of fun. We do amazing meals with some surprises this year, some upgrades to some of the meals are coming. But it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday that's the workshop. Wednesday's setup day, and then Saturday's a big party night. So most people do that camp anyway, stay over till Sunday, and we throw you off the property about 10 a.m. Sunday. But many people come, and then, after dinner on Saturday, they don't stay for the festivities, and they leave early to get home and back to their lives and all. So you don't have to be here all the days, but the days you don't want to miss, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Friday's barter blanket evening. That's one you really don't want to miss. It's one of the coolest things we do. You learn about a lot about yourself and others on the barter blanket as well. We have a rule about the blanket. It's kind of like Las Vegas. What happens on the blanket stays on the blanket. I'm not going to say why. You can figure it out for yourself, but we do have a rule. If I catch you videoing anything, taking pictures of an active barter blanket, your phone, your camera, whatever it is, goes in the fire. We're serious about it. Come on out and see why. Again, those are going to go on sale mid-September. I think it's the 19th. AI course on sale the end of the month. West Virginia at the end of the month. Let's go. Let's make some things happen. I'll catch you Monday with whatever we're going to call the Mondays. I'd love a suggestion. What Mondays? Something Monday. Right? Manic Monday. I don't know what it is. Give me an idea.
Said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.